This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Willie took out his cameras, and then suddenly he looked up with a sense of dismay, and he said, "I forgot to load the film." Here is this super spy with his camera skills, and he forgot to load the film.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In this riveting episode that peels back the layers of Cold War espionage, we sit down with Bert, an artist who unwittingly befriended a man better known as Colonel Abel, the infamous Bridge of Spies spy, who was exchanged for shot down US U-2 pilot Gary Powers. Bert knew Abel as Emil Goldfuss, however his real name was Willie Fisher from Newcastle upon Tyne in England. Bert's tale unfolds in a studio building exclusively for artists, where he first crossed paths with Fisher in an old-fashioned elevator. An encounter that would mark the beginning of an unexpected friendship. Bert reminisces about their shared moments, from the peculiar request for a cup of turpentine to late-night discussions surrounded by the haze of cigarette smoke. He reflects on the nuances of their bond, the fatherly figure he saw in Fisher, and the mutual need for companionship that transcended the spy's professional obligations. Don't miss part two of this amazing conversation. I'm delighted to welcome Bert to our Cold War conversation. Can you remember the first time you met the man that you knew as Emil Goldfuss?
Oh, very clearly, actually, because I tend to be kind of strangely focused, and I was entering the elevator in my studio building. This was an interesting building. It was the last one devoted exclusively to artist studios. There were no residents in the building. And usually the elevator is empty, and it's run by a mechanism that seems 19th century. You know, there's a kind of a wheel that runs the speed of the elevator up or down. And except for the guy who ran it, whose name was Mac, there was no one else in the elevator. And just before the door closed, the guy slept in. And I guess I only partially noticed him. He's wearing a tan raincoat and a sort of floppy hat. And I don't know what the protocol for elevator conversation is, but we didn't say anything, except we didn't avoid eye contact. I looked at him and nodded, and he nodded in return, as acknowledging our presence. And why was that exceptional? I guess it was reinforced by succeeding events, because it became a kind of an icon, almost, of city life. And at the same time, it changed, because the building itself was filled with people who were friendly. They were usually artists that talked to one another and so on. I had rented the studio right after discharge from the Army, and I served 2 years stateside in the Korean War. I'd also had a part-time job with the New York Post, which at that point in time in 1953 was a rather liberal newspaper, and nothing like what happened when Murdoch took over, so that it was a congenial place to work. And I worked as a part-time designer for the ads and adverts in the paper, which was great. I had a three-day-a-week job. That was a union job, but I negotiated it primarily because I wanted time off to paint. And the studio was my time off to paint. The union, by the way, was very annoyed and did not want to accept me for membership because it was a diminution of my dues paid. It was based, the dues paid up based on wages. And they thought I was filling a five-day job with a three-day one, you see, which was, I don't know. It was a kind of confusing thing, but I understood it in retrospect. So the succeeding days were without contact. And then suddenly this guy who I had just had the briefest eye contact with in the elevator, and that's another thing that reinforced that moment, showed up at 11 o'clock at night. I would usually work late. Knock on the door, and he asked if he could borrow a cup of turpentine, which I smiled about because it's a takeoff of a neighbor coming to ask if they can borrow a cup of sugar or something that they've run out. You know, the cup of turpentine was just this funny inversion. Anyway, I said, sure, by the minute he looked around and saw some of my work and became more social. He asked me, you know, how long I'd been painting, just casual things like that. And it was late, and he, again, thanked me and left. And then, of course, in the routine of coming and going, I ran into him again and said hello, and I asked how he was, you know, the usual conversation, and back and forth. And then he wanted to come and see more of my work. And over time, I guess without any kind of special reason for it, although in retrospect, I think there was. I was, after all, 25 or 26. My father just died. And this older fellow who was in his 50s, but certainly had the appearance to me of, I guess, a father figure, you know, the corny, awkward phrase, but someone I could relate to in a different way, not as a peer, but someone who would occupy a different role. And I wasn't quite sure what that would be. And over time, it became clear that, and again, in retrospect, and I want to make it clear also in this interview, that memory is often clouded by posterior view. We often make up little adjustments to events that need correcting in our memory. That somehow or other is more favorable or more interesting. So that's a disclaimer right at the start. But to be as honest as I can, and over time I've thought about, I came to look forward to seeing him because he provided a kind of sounding board for all my petty grievances and discontents. And at the same time, there was a mutuality about it. He clearly enjoyed my company for the very reverse need. And I saw that more clearly after his arrest and all of the information that came out about him, that he needed a family. He had a family in Moscow, which he was deprived of seeing for years. And so this this kind of quirky Jewish kid from Brooklyn served as an interesting complement to that. And also because he was seriously interested in art. Again, I discovered later on through a biography written by an Englishman, I think who was in academia, I can't remember, and I looked for the book, but my son had taken a book that was called Father and Son, and it was about Golphus Emu, whatever his name was, about his origins. And his father was a Bolshevik that had to flee Germany, and they were accepted in Britain, as a matter of fact, and wound up in,
Newcastle upon Tyne.
Yes. And where he was born, and he learned English very well. And he also had a kind of fascinating interest in art. He was not an untalented younger artist. Did a lot of black and white drawings. And the reason I knew that is by a curious coincidence, because my very lifelong friend, who is also my age and is hopefully getting the visit from me later on this afternoon. He had relatives who were Russian and living in Moscow, and who sent him a book of reproductions of Emil's artwork, starting from when he was a kid. And it was filled with color reproductions and so on. Clearly, the Soviets would try to build up this guy in a way that made him very appealing and so on. We'll get to that later, because I'm distressed by something in the Bernikov book that depicts his behavior in a curious, asymmetrical fashion. It goes to the question of identity, of who he really was, and who I knew, and whether he was exploited as a friendship, whether we used each other, all of those ambiguities. Makes a nice kind of discussion psychologically and even empirically. I don't know that I provided him with any information as his so-called professional status. But my friend David Levine became, who is now a noted caricaturist, who at that time was a struggling artist like all of us. He, I think, identified something about him that was a curiosity. I noted it, but didn't think about it until later. That he said that Emil had all the characteristics of someone who was a failed artist and who is searching in the company of younger artists to retrieve that lost career, something he never had a chance to pursue. And I run into that as a teacher over the years as well. I taught private classes for almost 40 years out of this studio. I've been here since 1970 in the same building. I'm the resident Eminent Grease of the street I live on. I'm reassuring to people when they see me going out the front door that all is right with the world. even though I don't walk as quickly as I used to. But more to the point again about the developed relationship and the fact that he was a committed young artist and that he did have some serious need for it. It was not... Bernikow mentioned the fact that it was one of the characteristics of, she thought, was his authenticity as a human being and as a friend, is that he was striving to be an artist. There's something about that that's beyond deception. I mean, you know, critics have said, okay, you know, he hung out with artists because that was the perfect cover. but I think that was the fact that he took a studio. Before he met me, he was a resident of this studio building for artists. And did he do it because he could have had any other kind of, he had multiple covers before that. Were they not sufficient? He was supposed to have been in a photo finishing business. I don't know if he was or not. But maybe something about his early life drove him to that. And the fact that he ran it to me and that I apparently had a great deal of the skills he was interested in, and also the character of my work, Peter Pan, because it was very much in the spirit of his own thinking at the time. I thought his paintings that I that developed the time I knew him were dreadful, awful. But I tried to be very encouraging and realistically. I mean, I wanted to help him, but I felt it was characteristic of a particular kind of amateur, someone who had these possibly glorious dreams of what art was about. And I must confess, I had some rather inflated thinking about what our art is all about.
What did Emil sound like, his accent? Because I've heard various descriptions of it being almost a bit Scottish or something like that.
Yes, he because he rolled his R's a lot. He called me Bert. Bert. Now, Bert is different. You know, it's a slight intonation, but more or less he was not accented decisively. Certain words that would have that kind of articulation. And somebody asked him about it once, and he said he was raised by a Scottish aunt in Boston. He had a lot of cockamamie stories to tell. Look, if you're in that job, you have a lot of cockamamie stories to tell. And it serves a useful purpose because he ingratiated himself. He very much wanted to be a part of this group that I was connected with. So that the texture of any relationship is hard to recall verbally. A lot of it is unspoken. He became friendly with David Levine and several other people who would normally be visitors at either my studio. Dave took a studio place, let me see, it was probably in 1956, in late 56, and a lot of his buddies came to visit, and Emil became a part of that social grouping. I mean, he enjoyed the company that he was in now. He had a place. He had a sense of himself reconstructed. It was the kid in Britain who was making all these drawings was suddenly reborn. Yeah. And so it was a useful back and forth conversation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Did you work on any paintings with him, or is he just observing your work and just talking to you about art and painting?
No, we didn't. I'm trying to recall very accurately. When he asked me to comment about his work, I refrained from actually touching the painting, doing anything to correct it. I would always do it verbally by pointing out, okay, you missed this, and this proportion is wrong, and that seems off in terms of perspective or something that was verbal. And he did come and sit on occasion and watch me work. And I think that was as instructive as it could be, because years later, people have come to just watch me do exactly that. But, and while I mentioned that at one point, I'd never had anybody around watching me work. But with Emil, there was a kind of understanding that it would be at a distance where I would be left alone, and even though we were in the same space. So that I remember one occasion when he sat at the corner of my studio, and it was getting late in the afternoon. I was about to turn the light on, and I turned around, and he was enclosed in a kind of dark spot with just a trail of cigarette smoke coming up. And it had a very movie-like kind of sequence to it, you know, that if you were going to film something, that, and the fact that he understood my need for a kind of privacy in the act, he still wanted to be in that space. And it was not just for thinking about it, and I don't know if this is accurate, it was not just for the instructional quality, but it was something about the companionability of it, that he could share that moment that was obviously a personal one, and that he might be the only one privy. Again, that's a retrospective thought. At the time, though, however, I was very touched by this man enveloped in growing darkness, just having enjoyed that time with the cigarette smoke trailing up from the corner of the room. So it's stuck in memory again. They're fragments of memory with all of this. Certainly things about, and you, if you need to jump to the whole issue of his assistant and the guy who fingered him.
Bert is talking about Rhino Hayhanen here, who was sent by the KGB to work with Willie Fisher and defected to the US in 1957. He surrendered information on Soviet espionage activities that led to the arrest of Willie and other Soviet spies in the United States and Canada. Bert then talks about the book Abel by Louise Bernicau.
Bernicau describes a lot of their interactions in a way that seems dissonant to the guy I knew, just temperamentally. There was something about his punitive relationship to this really drunken guy. It's very interesting. The vaunted KGB or NKVD. They didn't get any background checks on this jackal who they sent to help them. Either that or they wanted to get rid of him because they knew he would probably crack under pressure and expose him. So, you know, the deviousness of the Russians is hard to conjure.
I was going to ask you, you painted a portrait of Emil, which I've seen, and you depict his famous shortwave receiver in that painting as well.
Yes. I think it was a compositional thing. I'm not sure. There was something about the fact that it didn't work if it was lying flat on the table. You wouldn't see it. And I always said, why do you have that radio on its end. He said, well, there's some loose part in it that only connects when it's put on end. If you want to wait a minute, I don't know if you've seen, I did studies of him before I did what was a large painting, which my son, as a matter of fact, has in his apartment. But if you wanted to take a break for a moment, I'll just bring them and show you. Is that right?
No, that would be great. I hadn't realized you had those. Yeah. Oh, wow. Wow.
And I That's did incredible. That for compositional reasons. There was something about the fact that he was involved with all kinds of stuff, tools and everything else. I thought balanced against the fact that he's at the extremity of his table.
But, yeah.
And then there's another one. Oh, cool. I identified the radio with his expertise. And by the way, it's interesting, he was a craftsman of a kind, which I had another kind of thing about it. And then this is a different, and you can see there's a different mood in him.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
One of the characteristics of the work I do is that I'm a portrait painter with certain characteristics. People respond a lot to my work.
If you'd like to see video of Bert in his studio showing me his paintings, go to coldwarconversations.com/donate and select the monthly or annual support option. In addition to extra content, you'll also get ad-free episodes and more. Have you ever seen the film Bridge of Spies?
I saw fragments of it.
Okay. What did you think of the actor's portrayal of Emil in that? Did you recognize any characteristics of Emil in that?
It's difficult. I think the acting was very well done in that it gave a sense of someone who was resistant to any kind of question, you know, didn't want to answer anything, but had a certain composure about him. And that part of it, I think, was accurate. The rest of the movie I saw it on TV, actually, was typical Spielberg kind of hype. First of all, the lawyers for both the government lawyer who prosecuted him and the defense lawyer, Donovan, who was appointed, were totally different from this silly characterization of an insurance lawyer who was giving up his career because a horror of people at the thought that they would, that a lawyer would take the defense of this spy who is out to destroy America. You know, that kind of cliche. It's bullshit. You know, it's Cold War cliche. Fucking stupid. Because Donovan, first of all, was an ex-intelligence agent himself. Not agent is the wrong word. He worked in the precursor.
OSS,
to the,
I think it was.
OSS, yes. You know, precursor to the CIA. And so he was, in a way, a very safe choice by the government to provide him with defense. And at the same time, he did provide very active, very real defense for Golfus. I mean, they really made a strong case that went to the Supreme Court and I think was decided wrongly, which is not a big big news here in America, because they needed an excuse for a failure to detect an enemy agent, okay? So that and they had no real evidence against him. They only had Hay Hanen, who was the assistant testimony. And that was about nothing, because Hannon didn't know anything. He was merely a messenger boy. So whatever was sent via these little coins or other kinds of notes were undecipherable. No one knows what information he got. And certainly did it justify a possible death penalty. See, I mean, what was the gravity of his crime? Could he have been merely an industrial spy, sending information about various, and the Russians were doing that all the time in the post-war period, because their economy was destroyed. I mean, they were looking to reestablish some kind of credibility in their economy. So they lost a lot of people who were experts, and they were trying to get all kinds of ways to reestablish themselves. So there were industrial spies, certainly. Was he one of them? Who the fuck knows? And the indictment was secured on the basis of a conspiracy charge, where you don't have to prove the content of the crime. You only have to prove that there were a group of people who got together to do this illegal event. And even the evidence was gathered illegally, because the government tried to play a game of getting him to join forces with them. So they didn't arrest him for espionage. They arrested him on an immigration charge as a way of holding him in detention until they could get really more hard evidence. And because they didn't secure the evidence initially, by their first arrest, they came back later and scoured the studio and so on, tried to find, well, can I always have the instruments of some kind of deception? Again, but that evidence, however it implicated him in something, was also gathered illegally. But it's interesting, the judge threw out all the contentions of the defense, and Donovan, who was the lawyer, he had to be somebody really spectacularly important in order to justify getting the Russians to giving up our big important spy. So that was the kind of craziness of the Cold War. You know, yeah. It reminded me of two kids in the schoolyard puffing themselves up, saying, I'm this and I'm better than you. And, you know, I'm better than you because I got that. And the yeah. Soviets did the same thing. They started building Amel up to be, you know, super spy and super deceptive, which he wasn't.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Did you have any conversations with Emil about politics? One area I'm interested in is he was with you, I think, in 1956. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did he comment at all on the Soviet invasion of Hungary in October of 1956?
No.
And did that subject come up in conversation amongst the other painters?
Again, Bernica writes about the spirited political discussions and so on. I frankly can't attest to the accuracy of that one way or another, because it's not remembered. What I did remember was his neutrality. He really had no strong opinion about, very much about, certainly about McCarthy and the McCarthy travails in the early and mid-50s in America. He would shrug his shoulders, you know, like, that's the way the world is. But he was certainly not a weak-kneed liberal, nor a crazy, you know, extremist. It was certainly before the involvement in Vietnam, although by the late 1950s, we already had advisors going to Vietnam. I mean, all of the contentious issues on the left were absent from my memory of his conversation. Often, if there were any discussions, he would sit in the back of the room and listen, and kind of sometimes a faint smile would flash across his face. But it was, he had some credential, you see, as having been a kind of a wanderer in the U.S. I mean, he would talk about the fact that he worked in the lumbering camps in the Northwest and got to know the Wobblies.
The Wobblies was the nickname of the members of an international trade union founded in Chicago in 1905 called the Industrial Workers of the World.
And that was his contact with the left, and it was an exotic one, you know, something in the past. It was like talking about the socialist president, candidate for president of the United States. I mean, it seemed ancient history, long since forgotten by old men. That's the context of it. And by the way, just to stop, I hope I haven't talked around the issue. I'm trying to get a sense of what the experience was like in reality. When you read about it in the book or see and somebody try to recreate it in the movie, it doesn't quite connect, especially if the movie's riddled with all kinds of silly assumptions about whatever. The interesting thing about Amo was that his quote real self affected even his adversaries. I remember Donovan reported about how all the people in the bureau liked this guy. When I say liked this guy, you know, he was a spy, and they liked this guy. That's something that's a testament to me, who he really was, a human being. Look, we all come encumbered with a variety of masks that we need to wear. And we are all, therefore, deceivers like a spy in some sense. We have a social mask. We have a personal one. We have a familial one. We have a business one. Who are we? But the thing is that when we try to find out what that kernel of genuineness was, maybe I'm trying to resurrect something that need not be. You know, in the course of this whole experience, the BBC did a documentary back in the 90s on the spies who became moles, you know, who were illegals, it was called. And some crew came to interview me again about being the resident expert on it. And the interviewer was asking interesting questions, a very bright man. I should have kept notes on all of this, because it would make an interesting part of whatever the real story is. He became very angry at some point that I wasn't aware of who this person really was. And he said to me, do you know that he sat in a room next door to where people were screaming in agony as the NKVD were questioning him, torturing him? And I said, I don't know that you know that, but what I do know is that the people who carry my American flag around the world, creating equal horrors, if not worse, shame me much more than my relationship to Engel. You know, I've got to confess, I'm kind of naive. I really am, compared to other more conventionally practical friends of mine. Another of my old school chums, who's now also died. I was going to say passed away because I don't know where they passed to when they passed away. But he was a brilliant painter also, not highly recognized, but also in museum collections and so on. And he was a good buddy of mine. We traveled around Europe together and so on. And he came to me and he said, with his finger waving, and he said, there's something wrong with this guy, because I know a lot of people in the photo finishing business, and this guy doesn't connect with that, you know. So he's telling us some kind of story. And then afterwards, when he was revealed as a super spy, my buddy looked at me and he said, you listen to me. So, everybody accepted him face value. And again, because it was that kind of community of people sharing another objective. It wasn't, you know, how expert he was in anything or how much he knew or how well he dressed, although certain guys in the group thought he looked kind of like down and out. It was reported in the book somewhere that Jules Pfeiffer, who was another friend at the time, and I used to be very friendly with him, and I've lost contact with him, as a matter of fact. He may be in that class of super survivors like myself, because we are the same age. And he had a lot of important presence in the cultural world of New York. And he said he thought something about Amo was, he had the sniff of someone who was down and out, you know, and on the brink of starvation, and who never really recovered from that, even though he wore expensive jackets, you know, and had a certain dapper straw hat or something, that there was something embedded in that sense of failure in a person. I don't know. That's a psychological reason that I can't fathom. I thought that he felt not quite old world, but it was just, you know, it's a strange young person's perception of someone older. You know, what he looked like, was he hip, was he cool, did he really groove, did he look like he belonged at this time? I don't know. I never measured him that way, although there was something sort of like, oh, snuff in a box, you know, like not quite with it, but that was overlooked. There were other qualities. Listen, he was supposed to be a stern, almost vicious controller of Heyena, of this guy who fingered him. And Bernacow records conversations that sound, again, like not like the guy I knew, with one exception. I never heard him in a stern, kind of commanding voice. And it took me by surprise, but it was a stupid joke. You know, it was at a time when listening to Eastern European radio was somehow or other not very kosher. It was suspect. And the music we were listening to and the announcer on his fabulous on-end shortwave radio was from a Middle East. And when I was with him in the studio, I remarked, I said, "Oh, you're getting stuff from Eastern Europe." He said, "Yeah, I like the music sometimes that comes out of it." So was he in contact with somebody in the Soviet Union? Could be. But what his remark was, "Don't ever do that again on the phone, just in jest," was, I also read it as for my benefit. You know, that if in fact we lived in a world where we're being spied on by our own government, which a lot of people on the left were paranoid crazy about. It was too many of us for the FBI, which is not as competent as everyone says, of course. It wasn't a terrible break from reality. It was somebody, it didn't seem at the time self-protective. I thought it was like, you know, you ought to be more careful. Something I had not either remembered or ever seen, which was a film documentary made by David Brinkley for NBC in 1961, which was an interview of Hay Hanen and a secret filming of Abel in Atlanta in a prison. This was at a time just preceding the announcement, I'm not sure what the dates were, but where the exchange was made for Francis Peggary Powers. So for some reason, they were raising his visibility as this important spy. And that's the thing that's critical here, because my memory now is being taxed once again. Several years back, there was an interest story about something called Venona. The Venona Project was a big code-breaking operation staffed by women. I think I mentioned this before. Yeah. And I can't remember if, in fact, it exposed Abel as being the ringleader, five ongoing, exposed Soviet spy rings, including the Rosenbergs. So here again, I'm faced with the dilemma, which is something that comes up against my left-wing predispositions. And I confess to this up front. I have a tendency towards favoring a left view of the world. I think balance, it's the best one that describes our development, not only U.S., but worldwide, as a community striving for some kind of moral equity or fairness, justice, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. That being said, my tendency is to think that whatever was actually discovered by the Venona Project, it had a curious effect of, again, establishing the credential of our discoveries, that Abel was this super agent, even though they had nothing to convict him with. There was no evidence of anything he actually stole. I've mentioned that before with a conspiracy indictment. You don't need that. That was upheld by the court. There were other instances, again, of, and I didn't save it on the desktop here. I kept a record of some of the revealed deciphered notes that Venona had uncovered. And interestingly, in some of them, they described kind of everyday events, like, and I'm just characterizing it the razor, like Charlie failed to have lunch with his wife. You know, he should contact her. And it was like housekeeping material that was sent to agents that was really quite benign and dealt with, again, the kind of thing that Abel himself received as notes that were to keep him content. He was away from family that he apparently cared about deeply. So all of that is, you know, it's trying to put the pieces together to make some reality about all of it. And I don't want to fall into the thing of the mystery, except to say that what was confirmed from all of the people who had contacted him, all the official people, after he was in custody, they all found him with characteristics that in sequence were intelligent, humorous, interesting, inventive. I liked him. That was characterized by all of these. One of the attorneys that was part of his defense, along with Donovan, someone named De Beauvoir, was very, I wouldn't say complimentary in the ordinary sense, but he respected him greatly, as did Donovan himself. And when I think about it, the defense that they put up, going all the way to the Supreme Court, was really rather special, given the fact that he was, quote, the enemy of the country. And everything about the Cold War exaggerated our conceptions. It exaggerated the notions of patriotism. It exaggerated the notions of the effectiveness of espionage and the importance of it. All of those interactions were heightened that were, in historical sense and in the literature, discredited as being of any use whatsoever. Mm. Did they change events materially? Probably not. It made for interesting movies, and it made a whole career for, what's his name, the spy who came in from the cold?
John Le Carré.
John Le Carré, yeah. Yes. Oh, one item that I totally had forgotten, which was an encounter I was supposedly had, Bernico writes about it in some detail, with Donovan, that I met with him in his office in downtown New York, and that it referred to the fact that I had possession or had borrowed both the infamous typewriter and a guitar, which I had only half forgotten or half remembered at the time. But I don't remember the encounter with Donovan at all. And this was the event in which he asked me if I wanted to correspond with Abel. I think I like to call him Willie Fisher. That's easy.
Yeah, I prefer Willie Fisher, his real name.
Yeah. I mean, there's something reassuring about that for some reason, that everybody acknowledges it was actually his name. And anyway, so that's your act, you know, accumulated reflection on all of this that we've been discussing, perhaps usefully or not.
No, that is useful. I mean, any context is useful there. And I was going to ask you about your encounter with Donovan, because I had sort of found that in my research, that I think this was after his conviction that you met Donovan.
Yes.
And were I asked if you wanted to correspond with Abel. What I wanted to ask you was, were there times when Willie disappeared for sort of unexplained reasons, or you sort of thought, wow, where's he gone? I haven't seen him in quite some time.
To account for it, I would say two things. One, it was the very beginning of a lot of changes in my life. I met my future wife. I had gotten a special kind of connection with Sports Illustrated magazine to work with them freelance, and at a huge increase in income salary. 1957, 58, $14,000 was considered the median income. And so my income jumped from that to $20,000, almost 60%, working for Sports Illustrated, part of Time Incorporated. So it was an exciting time, a challenging time. I really didn't think much about, I mean, our relationship was both close and yet independent, respected each other. I never asked him about his private life. And as a matter of fact, with some surprise that I discovered one of the things they collected in the hotel was a bunch of condoms. And I never thought of him in terms of a sexual life because, quite honestly, and this is naively stupid, he was an older man. I mean, you know, he's done with that. He's only 54. So it was, again, you know, I never asked him whether he was interested in women or AIDS. And this is to round out my sense of connection with it, is that if you want to talk about a feeling, not just behavior, but a feeling about it, is that he gave me a sense of assurance in a way that things worked out, whatever it was, they worked out okay. If you talked about something that seemed extreme or catastrophic, he would nod and say, you know, he recognized that, but the nod was almost beyond wisdom. It was understanding that whatever I was feeling was premature or immature. And that was a constant nice thing to have with a friend and parody. As far as the friends in the studio building, primarily he made a connection with David Levine that was partly, I guess, because David was several years older than I, and I think he felt he was somehow rather more mature in handling practical events, which was not true. It was, and Dave used Willie's storeroom to store some of his own possessions. Willie apparently had this huge device that was a kind of multiple photo printing thing. I was really surprised about the degree in which he was involved in photography. And I have a funny story to go with that, if it's not out of context.
Not at all. Not at all. Any stories about Willie are good for me.
Okay. I had been in the habit of, or I was interested in painting some of the guys who worked in the nighttime food market in Lower Manhattan, where food is delivered at night into warehouses and then distributed individually throughout the city in the morning so that they fill grocery stores and supermarkets and so on. And I was interested in, like, who are these hidden people who do the work but we're all watching TV? And it fit Willie's interest also in the down-and-out guy, you know, the bum of the isolated individual, and it grooved with something that he felt some attachment to. So I told him at one point I was going to go to the markets to to try either to draw or to take photographs, because drawing is a little tricky at night, number one. And it's a challenge to anybody's drawing skills to get somebody hauling stuff in movement, you know, and they're going very fast, if it's whatever it is. I have some watercolors buried of things that I did that I could send you ultimately. And Willie got all excited, again, in a funny kind of childlike way. He said, oh, can I go with you? I said, sure, I'd love it. You know, great. Okay, so I said, we're going to go tomorrow night. You know, and I know you have several cameras, more expensive than mine, but we should go about 8 o'clock or something. I met him at the studio, and we took the subway downtown. Got up, and I went to a place where I could sort of safely take pictures without being intrusive or alerting people who we were or whatever. And Willie took out his cameras, and then suddenly he looked up with a sense of dismay, and he said, I forgot to load the film. Here is this super spy with his camera skills, and he forgot to load the film. I mean, that's something that I would have done, you know, that my incompetent kind of forgetful self. And it was such a turnaround from, in retrospect, thinking about this super efficient guy, you know, who's running 5 spy rings, and he forgot the film. It's very human, but it's also very characteristic of breaking through the stereotypic model that after all these people subject to, I mean, he had stomach problems, I'm sure, because it was suggested he had ulcers and so on, but that's not been identified. But it reminds me of your question of his absence. I started out by saying the preoccupation of my own career, my new married life, and so on. He just dropped because it wasn't the kind of relationship that was... He was always gone for several periods, several days, and they stretched into suddenly unimaginable long time. And suddenly I looked up and I said, it's 6 months since he's been here. And then I began to get worried, because what the hell could have happened to him? He said he was going off to sell his photo developing frame where you could get something which I didn't understand, and he didn't explain, to get multiple color prints out of a single exposure. Okay. And he was going to sell the idea to somebody. So I spoke to Dave and I said, we ought to call the cops, you know, missing persons. And he said, yeah, probably. How long has he been gone? He didn't remember either. You know, the relationship with all of us was so, it was both intimate and casual simultaneously. It's like we weren't keeping track of anybody. Anyway, I was about to call the cops, and I got a phone call. And at the other end of the line, he said, hello, Bert. And I said, Emil, where have you been?
We'll have to leave Bert and Willie at that point, so if you want to know what happens next, make sure you listen to next week's episode.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.